You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The writer Harper Lee has been herself written about as much as any American writer in the last 75 years. Her seminal novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, about justice, race, and class in the pre-civil rights South, has been beloved since it was published in 1960. It was also the only book Lee ever wrote. Lee stopped giving interviews years ago, and her life since then has been the source of much speculation. Madison-born Marya Mills this year published The Mockingbird Next Door, which chronicles the time she spent living in the house next to Lee and her older sister, Alice. The Lees had urged Mills to move there following a Chicago Tribune article Mills had written earlier. The book has elicited some controversy since its publication, mostly about the level of cooperation that Harper Lee actually gave, but the book's story isn't challenged. Mills is speaking at Boswell Book Company tonight, and she joins me in the studio now. Marya, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess probably the first question that almost everybody would have is, how on earth did this happen to you? You must have been pinching yourself.
There was some good luck and some good timing involved, and I certainly was. Both Harper Lee, or Nell Harper Lee, as she's known in her hometown in Alabama, and her sister, Alice Finchley, the attorney she calls Atticus in a skirt. Number one, we're pleased that the Chicago Public Library System had chosen To Kill a Mockingbird for their citywide reading program, which was the reason that my editor at the Chicago Tribune sent me to Monroeville, their hometown, and wanted to know more about it. So I think there was an element of just wanting to know more about what was happening with the program that they were pleased of. They're such great supporters of libraries. And I also met Alice Lee first, who served as something of a gatekeeper, among other things, for her sister. And there was such an easy, natural rapport there. She was so delightful from the start. And I think that's, you know, a good part of the reason that I got a call in my motel room one day at the Best Western in Monroeville from this husky voice saying, "This is Harper Lee. I wonder if we might meet." I think she relied on Alice's judgment when it came to a lot of things.
What struck me reading the book, and you draw their portraits so beautifully, I really felt like I knew them having read the book. But a lot of people must have had similar things like the Chicago Library Project. There must have been other things going on. You know, did you ever figure out what it was about you that made them say, "You're the one. You're the one we're going to talk to"?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't have a complete answer for that. I think, you know, there's something intangible, I think, that can happen among people where there is this kind of rapport. They've had more people than you would imagine, I think, feel entitled to an interview or an autograph of a book or meeting up with them. And so the fact that I wasn't pushing that, I think, registered. They have such a great sense of fun, which I think is something people don't know about them, because Nell Harper Lee has always been so private, famously so, and Alice Lee in that town was always known as quite a proper attorney, very principled. And so one of the things that surprised me right away, while I was still thinking, "My goodness, how is this really happening?" Was this sense of fun. There's a public reserve, but part of the real gift of spending so much time with them was seeing them among their friends and family, living life as they did in that small town. And the amount of fun they could eke out of a simple drive in the country where we got lost down some red dirt road, or the appreciation of some of the characters in that small town, and sort of human foible in general. It just, there was a lot of laughing that went on. And I think that's not always what people picture with them.
Or would think about, yeah. And one of the stories that comes back around is their love for the ducks and wanting to go and feed the ducks. And there was this whole routine.
Yes.
That was about, and it was like, it's time to go do that. And the ducks knew them.
Absolutely. In fact, Nell Harper's car, she had a Buick, and before that car even had stopped, pulled up and stopped at the curb, those ducks and geese were making their loud rush on the car. And then she had this empty Cool Whip free container in her trunk with hard corn kernels, and boy, a rattle of that container, and they came running. It was really striking to me though, how I think that that eye for observation, that it just shines through all throughout To Kill a Mockingbird, certainly, of how he's observing how people interact and kind of the subtleties in relationships was present even there with the ducks and the geese, which you would think, how much of that could there be? And yet I can remember how many times Nell Harper would be saying, now look, I think this, you know, this goose is looking to be the king goose here. Or look at how that injured duck is interacting with the others. I think they both had that eye for observation that just is how you live your life. It's contributed, of course, to the novel she wrote, to the kind of law Alice practiced, and I think really enriched how interesting their lives were, even in a small town. There was always something to be observing and analyzing and talking about.
Well, and you say somewhere towards the end of the book that that Nell wanted you to be there because you needed, she felt that to understand them, you needed to understand the town, the area, the people, and that the only way to do that was to participate in the life there.
It was such a gift as a journalist. Number one, to have that kind of time is just unheard of. And it really does make for a different kind of experience, I think, for everybody. But also the context of knowing them in the context of the town, of their friends, of their family, and of them as sisters, which was one of the real delights of this. They're so different and yet had such shared history and shared adoration, really, and admiration for their father, who had served as the model for Atticus Finch. And
who was unschooled in law. I didn't realize that until I read your book. Their actual father did the law, read the law, but was not trained.
That's right, read the law, as they said. And I think always had an appreciation that I think was really visible all those years later when I knew two of his daughters, in the appreciation of what it means to get an education and just the appreciation of, you know, he did not want a farm. He had come from a farming family. Didn't even want to grow a garden as many people did. He'd had enough time with his hands in the soil and I think had worked hard to be able to practice law and appreciated that that was what he was able to do. And you saw that all those years later with the Lees, I think, their appreciation of what education can do for people, and not just in terms of the job you get, but how you do look at the world as you go through it.
When you came down there to live in the extended time that you were, did you have any kind of prejudices that you needed to overcome about what life in the South was like?
Well, probably. What I didn't have, I think, that people in that town are often up against is a prejudice about small town life. My dad was born and raised in Black River Falls, Wisconsin, and have spent a lot of time there and really have an appreciation for the people there. And for me as a journalist, it was refreshing to see that there still was as much regional flavor there, literally in the food, but also in the language and expressions. And so many places, I think, now in the U.S. are homogenized, and they're far enough off the interstate, 100 miles from anywhere, in Nell Harper's words, that I think they had retained more of the flavor than a lot of places have. And that was great fun as a journalist. I think I was worried about being categorized too quickly as the Yankee or, you know, that people would assume I had prejudices. If anything, that was probably as much a consideration as anything.
But you didn't seem to find that. They seemed to accept you pretty well.
Well, and I think that's where the gift of time comes in. I mean, and I think it's true with so many preconceived notions we all have. Once you're in there having experiences with people and laughing with them, and a lot of that fades away. Part of that gift of time, I think, was that these were mostly people who were in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I'm 51 now, and this was taking place some time ago. They had time for me and you know, time to really get to know me as I got to know them. And it's just not what you normally have when a journalist is learning about an area and people. It was such a gift.
Yeah, most times you parachute in, you're in quick, down and dirty, and you're out.
Exactly.
And you never get an opportunity to really sink into some place.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, it was so interesting to go with them to Finchburg, which is where they had family on their mother's side originally. And hear them talk about the growing up, which, of course, for anybody who loves To Kill a Mockingbird, those are such vivid things. Scout is a tomboy in that town in Alabama, and the way that kids just explored that world without parents looking over their shoulder all the time. And some of these characters with different quirks that populated the town. And to hear them talk about those experiences when they were kids was just such a privilege. And that really was one of the things I wanted to convey to readers, was just what it was like to be in the backseat of that Buick, listening to them tell these marvelous stories. And with their eyes shining, I found myself often trying to find a synonym when I was writing the book for twinkle in her eye or sparkle in her eye, because so often the stories that I'm recounting were delivered with that. And
there was a sense almost like they were beaming.
They really were. Yeah, there was. And they had this eclectic circle of friends. It's one of the things I really appreciated so much about both of them, was their circle of friends was not all white collar or blue collar or one particular background or another. They just had this wonderfully kind of stitched together circle of friends. And it was fun to go on outings with them. A lot of it was eating out, as is true with an older crowd. The forever frustration there was that there were only a few restaurants, really. It's a town of 7,000 now. They had a few places that they enjoyed, but there's not that much selection. I said to Nell Harper over a meal one night, "So where do you go for a good steak around here?" And she just looked at me and said, "New York."
Which, of course, she did, because she spent part of her time, at least, you know, up until a certain age, in New York.
She did. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about her, is that she always had such a strong tie to Manhattan in New York City and to this small town that really was 100 miles from anywhere, in her words. And I don't know that there are that many people that are at home in both of those places that feel the tie that she did to both of those places. And it was one of the interesting things about her. She didn't fly, and so she would take the train back and forth all those years. And I remember thinking, well, you know, the country hasn't seen much of Harper Lee all these years, but Harper Lee has seen a lot of the country. She took cross-country train trips. She traveled in England quite a bit. So, you know, I think there's a difference between being private, as she most certainly was, and being reclusive, which is a word you hear often with her. But to me, that kind of conjures up somebody who's actually staying inside their house and not venturing out.
Did you ever get a sense, and I know it probably came up, about why she didn't continue to write?
Well, and that's such a striking question that everyone has, and that she, of course, has faced over the years. I felt there was a real glimpse into that at a breakfast that I had with her at a little hole-in-the-wall diner in Monroeville, which was her kind of place. The more it was sort of a greasy spoon, the better. And so we were just having breakfast one morning, and someone recognized her, came over. They had just a short, gracious exchange. The woman kind of nervously approached her and just said how much the book had meant to her. And Nell was, you know, delightful, spoke with the woman for a while. And then the woman walked away. Our eggs had cooled. And as the woman was walking away, I was thinking, that's a story she's going to tell for years to come. She was clearly thrilled. But just as I was thinking that, Nell turned to me and said, "I hope I didn't disappoint her." And I thought, which clearly she hadn't, but I thought, well, that's a glimpse at the weight of expectations that I think she's lived with in a very real way, really, since the novel came out in 1960 to such acclaim. So that, to me, that I think provides an insight into that question. She asked a good friend of theirs, Thomas Lane Butts, a Methodist minister in that area, who would also spend time in New York guest preaching, knew her, one of the few people really who knew her in both of those very different contexts. And she did say to him one time, "Well, Tom, do you wonder why I never wrote a second book?" And Tom, in his characteristic way, said, "Well, yeah, me and a million other people." And she said to him on that occasion two things. One, "I said what I have to say in the book. And two, I wouldn't go through all that publicity again for all the money in the world." And I think all of those things were factors. One of the strongest feelings I took away from that experience was that that was a decision that was not made early on and never revisited in the way that you kind of get the feeling it was, I think, when you read about her, that that was a decision she made early on. And then that was it. But clearly it was something that she revisited over time, as we all do, I think, with major life decisions.
We can't talk about this book without having you address the controversy that swelled up when it was first published. There was a letter that was purportedly written by Harper, or Nell, as we've been saying, that disavows any cooperation in the project. And so I guess I have to ask, how do you view that letter in the context of all the experiences that you had with the sisters?
She and her sister both were just so wonderfully generous with me with their time and with their insight and so helpful with this. And I think maybe three words to keep in mind when thinking about what you've mentioned there are imagine my shock, which were Alice Lee's words. The first time that a letter attributed to Nell Harper had gone out, this was when the Penguin Press had acquired the book back in 2011, and a statement attributed to Nell went out essentially disavowing the book and her participation. And unfortunately, Nell Harper Lee suffered a serious stroke in 2007, some years before that. But Alice Lee was still practicing law, and she then issued a statement saying that the other had gone out without her knowledge and that it didn't reflect her feelings or those of her sister, and reaffirming their help and participation. And I think that maybe gives you some idea about the situation.
Did it surprise you to get such a notice after all of this time that you'd spent with them?
It certainly doesn't fit with my experience with them. This was something that we spent a lot of time on together. And Nell Harper was specific about those things that she didn't want me to include. She has this way of crooking her index finger when she's making a point, and did many times about different things, including there were times when she would kind of point that finger at me as she was saying, now put that in there, meaning this is something I would especially like included in the book. There were certain myths and rumors and personal experiences that they especially were encouraging me to include. And she also would say, now this is off the record, and certainly those are things that I respected. We'd had quite a long working relationship by that time. I had known them for about 3 years when I moved next door with their blessing and encouragement.
Did you ever think to delay publication until they had both passed away?
No, I really didn't. I just took their wishes into account as they had expressed them to me, and the book that is out is the result of that.
You think they'd like it?
Oh, I do think so. I mean, it really, as much as possible, I wanted to reflect their spirit, the spirit in which they shared all these stories for the book, the spirit in which they've dealt with that interest all these years, the spirit in which they look at that town and their family. You know, a book is a chance to have a little more nuance, I think, in writing about their experience. And that was one of the things I really wanted to accomplish with the book, and I'd like to think that I did. That's the feedback that I've gotten from a lot of readers.
Well, Maria, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chicago-based Maria Mills is the author of The Mockingbird Next Door, Life with Harper Lee. Mills is a Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and this is her first book. Mills will speak about her memoir tonight at Boswell Book Company. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. For Lake Effect, from listener support at 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.